Well, I'm delighted to be here with you, brothers and sisters, and young people and friends. When Chuck called me, how long ago was it? A month and a half ago, and asked me if I would come to be with you, I said, well, Chuck, let me check my bones, my muscles, and what's left of my brain, and I'll be back to you. I really had to talk to my wife to find out whether she would agree. Because, the ravages of age. I was talking to Brother Dave just a few minutes ago, and, he's a young man, Christy. Do you know that? At any rate, I'm delighted to be with you. I think it's a privilege that we too often don't share the way we think we ought to. But the love of one another in the truth and in Christ supersedes anything else that we can do. Now that's tough for somebody of a secular incline to realize. It's tough sometimes for those of us who have been blessed with the truth to understand, because we're flesh. And our minds sometimes work diligently against paying attention to those things that we ought to pay attention to. Just remember that we are all in that same boat, and it's a struggle. So, some while ago, for good or ill, I pondered the subject of things that happened to some of the patriarchs of the past. What are the elements that we might gain from it? And from that developed this brief series of classes. How many of you have been to Washington, D.C.? Raise your hand. Put them up there where I can see them. All right. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Where are you, Chuck? 7. And 8. All right, that's about half of us. Now watch this next question. Those of you who have been to Washington, D.C., have you ever been down Constitution Avenue and read a sign that's engraved in stone on the Archives Building? Where are those hands? You have, Robin. Bless your heart. What does it say?
I don't remember it for words.
Very simple. What is past is prologue. Carved in granite on the outside of that building. Now, what I'm going to attempt to do, if my eyes permit me, is to share with you some of the items in the lives of the, not all of them by a long shot, but some of the patriarchs of old. And you will find a lot of the elements probably are old hat to some of you. That's fine. And maybe an idea or two that's somewhat new. But you heard what Chuck read from Paul's letters to the Corinthians and to the Romans. Paul emphasized, hey, look, he says, what went on in the past is our warning, our example, and we better pay attention to it. So that was the thrust of why I particularly looked at this concept. I'm going to take us to the lives, briefly, of Abraham, Moses, Samson, and Zacharias. Now, how long I'll spend with each one of them, I don't know. Now, what I'm trying to tell you is that in the four classes that have been stipulated in the program, they will not neatly fit into four components. There may be a runover. I'll let you know if that's the case. But we'll try, God willing, to deal with these four patriarchs. You say, well, now wait a minute, is Zacharias a patriarch? You'll notice he's the only New Testament element in what I'm talking about. So we're going to start out with Abram. And you say, oh boy, everybody wants to talk about Abraham. Well, I'm no exception. And we may deal with a few things that you've never considered before, and some things that are old hat. Now, particularly the youngsters here, and I'm delighted to see them. Now, if they don't think I'm not going to watch that table back there carefully, they better think again. Now, see, they're listening now, because all three of them smiled.
Am I not one of them?
I wondered why you moved back there, but be that as it may, we'll see how we go. Now, what we want to do in this brief series is to take a look at the actions and the reactions. Now, those are two different words. We can positively act, and then we can react to something that's acting on us. So we're going to take a look at both the actions and the reactions of these selected biblical giants from different angles to see what help that we might gain in our postures before our Heavenly Father. To benefit, as it goes, with the association and, watch this word, and the empathy with their experience. And we're going to test our own intellectual, spiritual, and practical actions and reactions to what we see. Now, on occasion or two, I will probably have a digression, and I'll let you know if it's a digression. Otherwise, you'd guess it without me telling you. Now, there's no question that some of these items are going to be old hat to some of you. I know that. I recognize that going in. But possibly a new thought or two to some of us. In any event, brothers and sisters and young people and friends, it has been a healthy experience for me, and I pray that it will be for all of us. Now, the youngsters will be excepted from the question I'm going to raise now. But those of you out there who have lived 35 or 40 years are not. I'm looking right at Judy. You know, I usually start from left to right. So the rest of you are not going to be exempted. So don't fall asleep on me. Judy, who was it not too long ago said, a political leader, we have Abraham to our father. Who said that?
Not long ago.
Oh.
You said this not long ago?
Not too long ago, within your lifetime. Within your adult lifetime. Now, I'm not trying to show you up there. I'm just trying to make a point.
I'm assuming this is somebody in Israel. Or
oh, very, very famous world political leader. It was the assassinated premier of Egypt.
Anwar Sadat.
And who did he say it to? Menachem Begin, the Prime Minister of Israel. When the two of them were in Washington and finally shook hands on an agreement between Israel and Egypt. But it was Sadat who said, Abraham is our father. And he was right. But these were two political leaders that were exchanging that kind of proposition. Now, where is that particular reference from? That's the amazing thing about it. I don't think Sadat really knew it, although he might have. That quotation comes from John the Baptist. It's recorded in two places, one in Matthew and one in Luke. In Matthew, the third chapter, now you're going to notice I have to lean over here every once in a while to read this, so bear with me. Matthew chapter 3, we find these words in a rather negative sense, the way John uses them. Matthew 3, and I think we'll look at the ninth verse. That's all we have to do to get us moving here. Verse 9. We have Abraham as our father, for I tell you, God is able from these stones to raise up children to Abraham. Now that was a response to the attitude that the Pharisees and the Sadducees were taking. because they were beginning to put themselves in a very debatable position against John the Baptist and ultimately against Christ. And John says, hey, don't give me that talk. Don't tell me that you can declare we have Abraham to our father and you can become a satisfied Pharisee or Sadducee saying, look, who is our father? Don't bug us. That's precisely why John was using that term. It was John speaking to those autocratic Pharisees and Sadducees because he knew what they thought. They thought to themselves, we have Abraham to our father and don't bother us. And John was trying to disabuse them of that thought. Now that's all the assurance they thought they needed. Now the true children of Abraham do have this assurance, but their mere and our verbal declaration of such doesn't amount to a hill of beans. Because what did John say after that verse? What came next? Look at verse 10. For even now the axe is laid to the root of the trees, and every tree therefore that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. He disabused them immediately. In effect, he's saying, you had better bear fruit or else. Don't go around bragging that Abraham is your father. Now you say to me, what in the world is Bill doing starting out with a situation like this? Do that simply to try to bring your minds into why we're going to look at Abram, later on named Abraham. We all know who he was, and we all revere his name. But there are some things that pricked my attention with respect to looking at this great father of the Jews in terms of how it impacts us. Now, brothers and sisters, I'm going to take about 10 minutes here, and I hope I don't bore you. But bear with me. There's a reason for this in terms of setting the context and where we're going to go. I believe sincerely that it's very helpful in any situation to view the context of the scene in history that we find things developing. And that's no less true of Abram than it is any one of us sitting in this room. Now, a lot of this that I'm going to talk to him now for about 10 minutes predates Abraham. Before Abraham. We're told in Genesis chapter 11 verses 27 through 32 that he was 75 years old before he ever came into the land of Canaan. We're told that specifically. We're told that he was 75 years old before he departed Haran. We know that before this he dwelt with his father and brethren in another city. Can you tell me what it is? Quick. Ur. Before that reference to Haran, he dwelt in Ur of the Chaldees. We're told that very clearly. Now, notice the youngsters are listening carefully because they've learned to listen about history lessons. Right? Well, semi-nods, anyhow. Now, he married his half-sister, Sarai. Now, we know she was his half-sister because it's recorded in Genesis chapter 20, verse 12. Now, after the death of his brother, Haran, he, his wife, and Lot, his nephew, migrated under the leadership of his father Terah from Ur to go to the land of Canaan. Now we could read that, but I think you know that. It's recorded in Genesis chapter 11. Now the family, this family that I just alluded to, departed Ur, not Haran, but Ur. If I had a map here, I can sort of pull a Harry Tennant here, David. Remember Harry and his maps with his hand? Ur way down here on the Euphrates River. And they departed to go up, not toward Canaan, but to up the river to Haran. All right? That's where that family went. And we're told it was 75 years old before they left there. All right? Now, they probably departed Ur later on along the famous route down through Damascus. But before we leave Ur, let me point out an item or two. Excavations that took place in 1854 and later on in 1922 to 1924 by Lord Woolley revealed that that city, Ur, way down here at the bottom of my hand, was actually occupied by people called the Sumerians about 3,000 years before the birth of Christ. Now, does that mean anything? Well, let's take a look and see if it does. That's the city that was there, established, inhabited some three millennia before Christ. And it's very interesting, I submit, that it apparently reached its zenith as a cosmopolitan city about 2,000 years, give or take a few, before the birth of Christ. That was Abram, let's put it that way, before he was renamed Abraham. That was Abram's home. Roughly a millennia after it had been established as a going concern, that's where they left to go to Haran. All right? It was a period where our archaeologists tell us there were immense temples, not to the God of Israel, but immense temples. And they were closely knit together with housing units that they have proved existed through archaeologists' discoveries. And that probably a 500,000 people lived there around 2000 B.C. Now, I don't care what kind of crowd you're talking about, but 500,000 people is a lot of people. All you got to do is go through the St. Louis airport and you find out about that. They occupied an area of about 4 square miles, so they were pretty closely bunched in there. Now, Ur was a principal center of worship for the moon god Zin, Z-I-N. And it continued to be embellished by the great kings of Babylon. And those of you who studied history remember some of them. Ever hear of Hammurabi? Of course you have. He was a great king of Babylon sometime around, it depends on whose work you're looking at. The Encyclopedia Britannica says about 2067. Other people say it was about 1728. I'll get my figures straight here in a minute. Now, a great city right down to the time of Nebuchadnezzar. And that was 600 B.C., right? Yeah. Now, it is for sure, and this is the reason I have given you that little tidbit. It is for sure that Abram's family came out of idolatry. There's no question about that. Joshua chapter 24 verse 2 says quite plainly, your fathers dwelt on the other side of the river of old, and they were talking about the Euphrates. Even Terah, the father of Abraham and the father of Nahor, and they served other gods. They were idolaters. Abraham's father, Terah, worshipped other gods. Now there's an interesting point that I'm dwelling on this. I said I didn't want to bore you, but I wanted to set this pattern for a particular purpose. Now before we leave this idea, let's talk about Haran. Remember now, we came from Ur way down here, went all the way up to Haran. How come they didn't go to Canaan? They went up to Haran, right up the Euphrates River. And you might say, well, they were going through Haran on their way to Canaan. But you know something? They stopped in Haran. But more about that in a moment. Now that place is a city of Mesopotamia on the Balak, which is a tributary of the Euphrates. It's not all that far from Nineveh, and only about 280 miles north-northeast from Damascus. And we all know about Damascus. I think we do, at any rate. It was a commercial center on the main trade route between Babylonia and the Mediterranean Sea. It was a very, very important port. That's where Terah died. He died in Haran. And apparently, Abraham sojourned there for a while, at least long enough to have possessed substance and servants. And I'm going to read to you a verse that tends to support that. We're talking now about Genesis chapter 12. Now, a lot of these you're familiar with, but the chronology is quite important. Genesis chapter 12, verse 5, I believe is what we're looking for. Just to make sure I don't mess up here. Verse 5. And Abram took Sarai his wife, and Lot his brother's son, and all their possessions which they had gathered, and the persons that they had gotten in Haran. And then they set forth to go to the land of Canaan. So he must have been there long enough to acquire what we were just told about in that particular verse. Now it's interesting to note about this city Haran that over 1,000 years later, after this incident that we just read about, we find the Rabshakeh, that is the head general of Assyria's Sennacherib, and you've read that word more than once, the Rabshakeh. All that means is it's a top dog, the top military leader. That's what he was. And when he was talking to Hezekiah, he was laying down all kinds of threats. And you know what he did? This is 1,000 years later than what we were just talking about. He included it in the litany of cities conquered by Assyria. We find that in 2 Kings chapter 19, verse 12, which reads this way. Have the gods of the nations delivered them whom my fathers have destroyed as Gozan and Haran and Rezpah? That's a how long's a millennium back there?
1,000 years.
1,000 years. How long's the United States of America been in business? Just a bit more than 200 years, right? So when you start talking about a millennia, you're talking about, I mean, it's mind-boggling in terms of the length of time we're dealing with. That city was still there, and it was still included in what was conquered by Sennacherib. It's interesting to note that it's still, today, 2001, it's still a small village in the nation of Turkey, called Haran. Ever been there, Brother David? I know you do a lot of traveling. I thought maybe you'd been there. I wasn't sure. Okay. Now, apparently, this family left Haran after Terah died. In all likelihood, they followed the road by way of Damascus in Syria. Even in those days, there was a great highway that existed between Mesopotamia to Canaan, which went right by Damascus. Of course, it's still in existence. Again, I'm going to leave your older brothers and sisters out of this for a while. Where's Damascus back there? I don't know. They're honest kids. If they don't know, they say they don't know. Where's Damascus?
Syria.
It's the capital of Syria, isn't it? Been around a long time. A long time. Now, I believe, brothers and sisters, that we can conclude that Abram left Haran and he did not stop along the way very much on his way to Canaan. We're told that he was 75 years old when he left Haran, very plainly in the 12th chapter of Genesis, verse 4. It says he was 75 years old when he left Haran. And he spent 10 years in Canaan before he took Hagar to wife. Now, let's take a look at that. That's in Genesis chapter 16. And you'll notice the chronology, by and large, that we're following here for a while. Genesis chapter 16, the first three verses read this way. By the way, I'm basically reading from the RSV. Every once in a while you'll hear a quote from the King James, which is fine. They're both saying the same thing. I personally believe that the RSV is a little more accurate in the use of words than is the King James. But be that as it may, I'm basically reading to you when I open the Bible from the RSV. Okay? You with me? Now, we're in the 16th chapter, the first three verses, they read this way. Now, Sarai, Abram's wife, bore him no children. She had an Egyptian maid whose name was Hagar. And Sarai said to Abram, "Behold, now the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Go into my maid. It may be that I shall obtain children by her." And Abram hearkened to the voice of Sarai. So after Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan, Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar the Egyptian, her maid, and gave her to Abram, her husband, as a wife. So he was in Canaan 10 years before he took Hagar. We're gradually getting there. You're beginning to add those things up, aren't you? If he was 75 years when he left the one place, and it was 10 years after he got to the other place, how old would that make him?
About 85.
That's a good answer. About 85. You're absolutely right. He might have been 85 and a half, 86, but that's the time frame in which we're talking. So as a matter of fact, I believe he was 86 years old when he took Hagar to wife, because it took him about a year to get down here. All right? Now, so not more than a year elapsed between the departure from Haran and his arrival in Canaan. Now, for a perspective, a word about the size of the community under Abram. In addition to his wife, his nephew, and servants acquired in Haran, we already found that mentioned in Genesis 12:5. He certainly took unto himself additional servants by purchase, by gift, and undoubtedly by birth. Now this we will take a look at scripturally too. We're now in the 17th chapter of Genesis. Oh, let's see. Let's take a look at verses 23 and 27 of the 17th chapter of Genesis. Verse 23, "Then Abraham took Ishmael his son and all the slaves born in his house or bought with his money, every male among the men of Abraham's house, and he circumcised the flesh," etc., etc. So we're just told in an offhand way those that had been born, those that he'd bought. So his retinue was increasing, right? Now look at chapter 20, verse 14, I believe it is, yes. The 14th verse of Genesis chapter 20. "Then Abimelech took sheep and oxen and male and female slaves and gave them to Abraham." Now that was involved in that proposition with his wife Sarah. But here's Abimelech. Not only was Abraham pretty big and powerful already, but this man gave him more. You might say in today's vernacular he was building a dynasty. But at any rate, it was growing. Abraham, and those names are becoming interchangeable now, was rich in flocks and herds and their necessary accompaniment, men servants and women servants. Genesis 13:2 tells us that Abram was very rich in cattle and silver and gold. And one more quick reference that will suffice to make this point. Genesis chapter 24. Let's see. Verses 34 and 35 of Genesis chapter 24. "I said, I am Abraham's servant. The Lord has greatly blessed my master, and he has become great. He has given him flocks and herds, silver and gold, men servants and maid servants, camels and asses. The detail by which we're told what was accruing to Abraham is very important in some of the elements that I'm going to share with you today. Very important, at least in my opinion. We'll see whether you share it or not. Now, there's no question, by the brief look-see that we've had, that Abram was very great, powerful, and rich in the eyes of his fellow mortals. Now hold on to that for a moment. He had to be rich, considered great and powerful in the eyes of his fellow mortals. Among men, now let me put this question right to you. How would you feel with that kind of wealth and power? Put yourself in that position. Ask yourself that question. Man, if I've got all of these resources and all of this power and reputation, boy, I'm sitting as king of the hill. So when we put ourselves in that position, we say, oh boy, that's quite a test. Quite a test. Abraham had all of the elements that society would deem necessary to trust in his own might. And of course, the world is full of that to this day. But that's the position Abraham found himself in. Now remember, he'd come out of idolatry. More about that in just a moment. But he had gained the wherewithal, the resources, the power, the reputation. Man, I can do anything I want to do. Don't get in my way. I don't know whether that thought went through his mind, and I'm not suggesting that it did. But if we put ourselves into that kind of position, we wonder sometimes how arrogant and mighty we would feel ourselves to be. It's a question worth considering. But, brothers and sisters and young people, and here comes the real but. Not B-U-T-T-S, but B-U-T. But, nestled within the record of Abraham and his relationship with God are instances of four great crises from which each one of us can learn. Four great crises from which each one of us can learn. Not only of the man and why God thought of him as he did, but as examples establishing the principles to follow in keeping our own, all too often, faltering priorities straight. We can feel real empathy when we look at these crises, because in each one was the involvement of surrendering something which, from a natural viewpoint, from a natural human viewpoint, was most dear. Before pursuing these occasions, and we're going to do it, let's impress upon our minds the principle enunciated by Jesus in Matthew 10, verses 36 and 37, where we're told that Matthew stated this. You needn't turn it off unless you want to. He said, a man's foes shall be they of his own household. He that loveth father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he that loveth son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Now, I would suggest to you that this is a history-long principle. The principle has been absolutely rock solid through history. Now, remember the time frame of Abraham, roughly 2 millennia before Christ, give or take a few years, 2,000 years before Christ was ever born. And the principle existed then, and it still does. First crisis. Give up your country and your kindred. Put yourselves in that situation. Go ahead. Give up your country. Give up your kinfolk. Give them up. This was a trying precept. Whether he loved God better than his native soil and presumably his natural fellow associates. Whether he could willingly leave all that to go along with God. Now the country was idolatrous. We've already seen that. His kindred, undoubtedly a constant temptation to him. He certainly could not continue with them without the danger of being infected by them. The command which God gave Abraham is much the same as with the call of the gospel by which the spiritual seed of Abraham are brought into covenant relationship with God. Now, I don't believe there's a person in this room. There may be some, but I don't know it, if that's the case. That don't fit into this point I'm trying to make here. Our natural affection must give way. And each one of us have a natural affection. Our native land may be dear to us. And we have certainly been blessed as citizens of the United States. There's no question about that. And I don't believe that we would transfer our position, whatever that might be, in the United States with some other country. Oh, we might go back to Scotland or Germany or France or what have you. But we have a natural tendency to like the native land in which we find ourselves, don't we? Okay. The point is made by Jesus in Luke 14:26. Now, these words I have had to deal with a number of times with people who have asked me about them. Now, it's Luke 14:26. Now, you can look that up if you want to. I'm simply going to tell you what it means. That's where Jesus said that you must hate your, in effect, your family and your upbringing. You must hate it. That's a strong word. It's a strong word in the vernacular that we use these days. If somebody says, I hate you, boy, that's pretty tough stuff. And here's Jesus saying you must hate. Now, is that consistent? So when you look at it carefully, you've got to understand this is a term of affection used in a comparative sense. Our natural affection as compared to our love and devotion to God and His Christ is to be, as it were, hate. Them in comparison with Him when and if they are in competition with Him or His will. And that's the bottom line. It's very tough for us to understand. But that's what Abram had to do. Oh, more about that in just a moment. And then we'll have our first break before too long. Remember, I told you that we might go from class to class with some of these things. And we will! So bear with me, God willing. The occasion for sin must be forsaken, particularly bad company. And oh boy, is it easy to get involved with bad company in this modern secular society. You know that as well as I do. I have a few years on most of you, but I can tell you it's a very real principle. Those who would follow God or God's will, must quit the society of evildoers. Remember what Peter and John told to those 3,000 people who were baptized after the Pentecost declaration. And they didn't say only get yourselves baptized. They said save yourselves from this untoward generation. Now that's one of the interpretations of the Greek word. Another one I think is even better. Save yourselves from this perverse generation. It existed then, and it still applies as a principle for us today. The society that we find ourselves in must be looked upon with a holy, H-O-L-Y, a holy indifference. We must not look upon it as our country or our home, but as a temporary dwelling place. Maybe a hotel, if you want to use an element. Because we know, because we possess God, be thanked the truth, we know that our enduring country is yet to come. It's a tough thing for people to swallow. It's a tough thing for people to respond to. But you know, that's what Abraham was forced to do in his first major crisis. Abraham was tried in this command. Now watch this one. He was tried in this command whether he could trust God further than he saw him. He must leave his own country and go to a land that God would show him. That's what the record tells us. God didn't say where. And what he did say here was, quote, the first verse of chapter 12, it's a land that I will give thee, but merely didn't say, but merely one that I will show thee. He didn't tell Abraham he was going to give him that land. Simply said, I'm going to show it to you. Well, forgive me for these sometimes ridiculous analogies. How many of you have been to Hawaii? I know several of us have been, yeah. Beautiful place. Gee whiz, that's a nice place. Nice to be there. I'll show it to you, but I'm not going to give it to you, David. That's the very principle we're talking about here. God told Abraham, look, I want you to do thus and so, and I'm going to show this to you, but he didn't say I'm going to give it to you. Later on, it was a different ball game. But at this point in the chronology, he did not tell Abram that. Do you understand that? Of course you do. And it's helpful sometimes to put it into that perspective. Boy, he had to respond to God's command to come without really knowing what the bottom line was. He didn't have an accountant that was going to add it up and come up with a bottom line. Later on, it's another ball game. But at this stage of the game, it took an awful lot of trust. Now, like Abraham, we must quit the things that are seen for things that are not seen in hope of a glory that is yet to be revealed. Putting up with whatever suffering and inconvenience we encounter as a result of our faith. And those two are not separable. A constant beacon. I reckon that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. Now, Paul had the perspicacity to tell that to the Romans. It's recorded, as you know, in the 18th verse of the 8th chapter of Romans. In fact, John says that it doth not yet appear what we shall be like anymore than it did for Abraham at this time. He didn't know. It was a pure act of faith. Now, I think this might be a good time to take a brief break before we get into the second crisis. And I'm going to tell you what that crisis is. And if you want to ponder it during the break, be my guest, and then we'll deal with it. The second crisis was the necessity to separate yourself from your favorite nephew. Very interesting. And we'll talk about that at the appropriate time.